So without wasting any more time, let me introduce my hero and our hero, Roger Penrose, to speak about twisters and quantum non-locality.
Well, thank you very much, Neil, for that extraordinarily flattering introduction. I hope I can do justice to this. Now, that isn't on yet, so I have to do that first. Right. It's not the easiest subject to talk to a general audience about, but I'll do my best. In fact, I'll use a slide here, which is, as you can see from the kind of grubby look about it, is a very old one. It's gives you the general idea of what a twister is, in a certain sense. Here we have, that is supposed to represent space-time. Here we have time going up the picture, which is usual in my pictures, and space going off horizontally. It's supposed to be three-dimensional this way, so you can see the three arrows there. But of course, it's hard to draw all the dimensions, especially on a flat piece of transparency here. Now, here we have a light ray, and basically that gives the initial picture of what a twister is like. So space, first of all, you have to get used to space-time already, so we'll assume that you're not unhappy with the idea of space and time all being fitted together into one thing, which is a four-dimensional space-time, as we call it. Well, what's this? This is the history of a light particle, say a photon. So it whizzes along at the speed of light, and you scale things so that space and time are, well, if your measure of time is 1 second this way, then it has to be 1 light second that way. That's a long way, actually. But don't worry about that. We like to draw our pictures so that light rays are at 45 degrees. That's just handy, because otherwise, you know, if you had a normal, they'd be more or less horizontal. So, okay. You'll notice that there's a sort of corkscrew attitude to this thing. Well, you might wonder what that's doing. Well, that's because a twister really is not just a light ray, it characterizes the spin of the particle as well. So photons actually do have a spin, and they can either spin one way, right-handed or left-handed, or combinations of the two. And this is supposed to indicate that this thing is spinning in the direction, I think it's meant to be right-handed in this case. Now, what's this over here? That part of the picture is the space of twisters. So one entire light ray is the single twister. And so that over here is represented by a single point. So that point is supposed to represent this thing here. And the idea is to think of this space, which is the twister space, as being in some sense more fundamental than the space-time. And you might say, well, how do we reconstruct this space? How do we reconstruct space-time, which is this space over here, from the twister space? Well, you say, take a point here and look at all the photons going through that point and all the light rays through that point, and they will represent a sphere. That's really the sphere. Well, I've got another picture down here. So if you look out into the sky, this is your light cone, which is showing the light rays coming into your eye as you look back down, and you will see a number of stars, perhaps. And those, the world lines of those stars, that's the histories of the stars, in the space-time picture, which is here, and they will intersect your past cone, that's the light rays coming to your eye, each one will be the point you actually witness when you see that star. And this is the field of vision that you might see. I've got four stars here, and it so happens that these four stars lie on a circle. There's a good reason for that, which I'll come to in a minute. But this thing, which I've called a Riemann sphere, and I'll try and explain why it's called that, represents all the light rays through that single point. So that point, well, it's a point in space-time, so called an event. An event is a point in space-time, and that is represented by that sphere. So if you knew in this space where all these spheres were, which represented points here, then you would be able to reconstruct this space from that one. So the idea is it's a sort of correspondence. You can go backwards and forwards, Then you might say, well, why bother? I mean, you could do it here. Why? What's the point of this? But the point is that it reveals all sorts of structure that you don't easily see in space-time. And I've listed a few of the things here. Complex. Now, I don't mean complex in the sense of complicated. I mean complex in the sense of complex numbers, which I'll come to. In fact, I might as well dump them down here while I'm talking about it. Here we have, I'll come back to that, but complex in the sense of complex numbers. Non-local, well, that's part of the title of the talk, so I ought to be saying something about that. And it's the sense that things, there are phenomena in nature, particularly revealed by quantum mechanics, which are not local. You can have things which are related to each other, they look as though they're a long way away, and somehow they're all part of one thing, and you can't regard them as independent, separate things. It's a very mysterious feature of quantum mechanics, which is the point of this talk, trying to grapple and look at this in a different way, which somehow makes sense of it in a way that you wouldn't really make sense of it if you just had this picture. So that's part of the idea. And I'll try and say a bit more about that sphere. And the sphere appears again over here. It's the same sphere, really. You see, this sphere represents all the light rays through this event. And now, if you take this event here and you look out, you'll see the light coming into your eye, and you see various stars, and that's, if you like, your celestial sphere. So it's the sky you see when you're out in the dark night and you look at the stars out there. Well, especially if you're out in space, then you could see all the way around. The Earth tends to get in the way if you're on the ground, but apart from that. And there's a rather strange feature that these spheres have. You see, here I've got a picture of two different observers looking out at the same sky. They just managed to miss each other, only just, at the same point, basically. And they look out at the same sky, but they're going at different speeds, very hugely different speeds. Imagine they're, you know, one of them might be going at half the speed of light or something. And looking out at the same sky, okay, they seem to see the same stars. The sky is distorted in a way because in the direction you're moving, things tend to crowd in. It's a thing called aberration. But it's distorted in a very particular way, which is such that the circle here, which I've got those stars which happen to lie in a circle, they'll still lie in a circle to the other observer. Okay, well, I'll come back to these features later. I think I just want to leave this here for the moment, so you'll see the general idea of twisters. And let me say something more about this other thing, which I don't think I commented on yet, maybe because it looks a little forbidding. Mathematically sophisticated. See, that is one of the things that, see, it depends. If you're a mathematician, that looks nice. You say, oh, that's good. But if you're not a mathematician, it's a little bit daunting. So I'll try and explain some of these ideas in a way which I hope is reasonably accessible. Okay, first of all, we need to know about these complex numbers. So we have numbers which involve a square root of minus 1. Well, the square root of minus 1 is called an imaginary number. You might think it's not really there if it's called an imaginary number, but you have to bear in mind that it's just as real as any other kind of number. These things were first thought of many, many centuries ago, and then mathematicians began to realize that they were useful in many ways, but they're still kind of, you might think of them as inventions just to help you. But in fact, they turn out to be deeply embedded in the way the world works at the level of the small things that are governed by quantum mechanics. So we'll come to that. Okay, so complex numbers mathematically are very useful. They enable you to solve algebraic equations. I've written one sort of randomly here. The thing is, you can solve all of them. That's what's amazing about them. You just start with a simple equation like x squared plus 1 equals 0. Well, x squared would have to be minus 1, you see, and that would be the square root of minus 1. So the miracle is that all you have to do is have something which solves that peculiar equation, which is the square root of minus 1, and then you can get all the solutions to these equations, no matter how complicated. This is z to the 100. That's a pretty big equation there. And then there are other things like when series, like this series you write down, when does it converge and when does it diverge, and the sum of it doesn't give any indication of that. Whereas if you go into the complex numbers, you see, you understand that. Okay, now what is a complex number? It's a thing like this, z equals a plus I is the square root of minus 1, times b. And a and b are ordinary, what we call real numbers. Well, even then there's a question, why are they real? You see, only real because you're sort of used to them somewhat. But they're infinite decimals, and is that real? I mean, you worry about it on your your calculator or your computer. You can only put down a certain number of those decimals. Do all those decimal places mean something? So you might ask the same question. Are these so-called real numbers real or not? So that's the sort of question we mathematicians like to answer and say, well, they're all just as real as each other. We like to think they're all real, so that's fine. Okay, now it's not just that. As I said, these numbers are fundamental to quantum mechanics, absolutely fundamental. Up until that point, the numbers have been just useful in many ways. They're useful, for example, with electrical circuits. If you want to understand about electrical circuits, you use these complex numbers. But it's just a sort of trick. Whereas here, they seem to be revealed actually in the foundations of the way the world operates. They're not just a trick, they're really there. That's a subtle point, but it does seem they really are there in a sense. See, here I have when I write that funny kind of C, that stands for the complex numbers. And they play important roles in many attempts at physics, basic physics, such as in string theory and, we'll see, in twister theory. So I try to reveal some of that, and we'll come back to this slide because it gives a sort of summary of the ideas of twister theory in a sense. I'll go back to the complex numbers. This is sometimes called the Argand plane and the Gauss plane and all that, but it really should be called the Wessel plane because it was Caspar Wessel, who was a Norwegian surveyor and mathematician who apparently first thought of this way of representing these complex numbers. You represent them in the plane, the real numbers going this way, and the multiples of the square root of minus one that way, and then you fill out all the other numbers, which is a sum of a purely real number and a purely imaginary number, as it's called. And then you can add them and you can multiply them, and it's quite nice if you have a geometrical turn of mind that each of these is a nice piece of geometry. You see, to add W and Z, you just form this parallelogram, and there's the sum. And if you want to multiply W and Z, well, you need to know where the origin is and where 1 is, and you look at that triangle, and then you make another triangle which is similar in shape. It can be bigger or smaller, but it's the same shape as this triangle, and there is the product, ZW. So you can add and multiply just using nice bits of geometry. There's also this notion of a holomorphic function, which is really very important in this subject. Okay, it's a rather complicated sounding word. What does it mean? Well, the way I'd like to look at it, it's quite simple, really. It's built up from adding, subtracting, multiplying, dividing, and taking a limit. Taking a limit is if you keep on adding something together, say, as in the series, which I think is covered up here. 1 minus x squared plus x to the fourth and so on. Things where you have to do, and essentially you go to infinity and take a limit. But limits are not such a difficult idea to come to terms with. So adding, multiplying, in fact you can build up some of the others out of some of the others, but never mind, and taking a limit. But what you can't do is express the thing called the complex conjugate. So if you have x plus I times y, and that could be this point z up here, then the number which is called the complex conjugate is replace I by minus I. You see, if you have a square root of minus 1, as we have here, you might know about square roots. If something is a square root of something, then minus that something is also a square root of it, so plus or minus. So that minus I would have done just as well as I. So you could say, well, those would be taken minus I instead. Well, this operation, which flips you over from the number to its complex conjugate, that's reflecting it in this real axis. That's not holomorphic. So we think of Z and Z bars, in some sense, independent things. That's the way you're supposed to think about them. And if it doesn't involve the barred one, then that's holomorphic. That's another way of thinking of it. Okay, that idea we'll come back to, and that's a bit of this mathematical sophistication thing. But you think of it this way, it's not so complicated to think of. In fact, it's one of the things, when I was learning about these complex numbers and things at university, I thought they were just incredibly magic. And this is some of the thing about them is that one of the reasons that I feel that it's really nice to see them as part of the way the world operates is there is a magic about them. And I like to feel that the laws of physics are magical in a way, and somehow this magic is governed by the mathematical magic of these numbers. And the fact you can solve all these equations, if you like, that I've written down here, That's part of the magic, that you get it out of just this one little thing and you can solve all these equations. There's lots of it. You keep seeing it again and again and again. And one of the things which really struck me when I was learning about these numbers as an undergraduate was that if you have a function which is smooth, you imagine a function, you draw a graph or something like that, and it might have kinks and bumps in it or steps in it. That's not smooth. So you might say, well, let's say that it's nice and smooth. It has a nice tangent line to it everywhere. And then, okay, then it could be smooth in that to that degree, but then it might be a little bit more subtle, not smooth, and so on. And there's all sorts of different gradations of smoothness when you talk about real numbers. But with complex numbers, there's just one. As soon as you say it's smooth once, it's infinitely smooth. And that was, to me, a miracle. I'm not going to try and explain that because that's a little bit more technical than this talk is meant to be. But I just want to try and impress on you that there is this deep magic, which is the thing that impressed me right from the start. And to feel that that's really something which governs the way the world operates is something that strikes me as, well, maybe that's the way it should operate, if you like, something like that. Okay, now let me say something else. You see, I've got adding and multiplying. Well, subtracting is not so different from adding. What about dividing? Okay, well, once you know how to multiply, you basically know how to divide. So let me put that in here. It's just the same picture as the one I have here, but I'm doing something else to it. I'm going to think of not just multiplying z and w to get wz, to get multiplied together, but I'm thinking of dividing q, which is going to be wz, by z. So if I divide it by z, you just go back down the picture, and it's that one. So that's not very difficult. If you've got this triangle here, and it's the same shape as that one, they're similar, then you can see what the division of this number by z is. But you know, when you divide, there's a snag, because you're not supposed to divide by zero, and that leads you into all sorts of trouble. Okay, so let's see what happens. If I push z right down and make it get smaller and smaller and smaller till it gets to zero, what happens to w over z? Well, this point goes shooting way out like that, and it goes off the picture when you get to zero. And it doesn't much matter. I can go into zero in all sorts of different ways. It just goes off to infinity in different ways. Now, there's a very nice way you can handle this in complex numbers, and that is you take this vessel plane, as I have here, and you sort of fold it up into a sphere. So you add a point right out at infinity, which will help so that you can actually say what you mean by dividing a number by zero. It's infinity. You might think, well, infinity is not really a number. Well, it is here. It makes... That's the nice thing about mathematics. You can cheat, you see. You can say that you're not allowed to do this, and then you think, well, what happens if I do that? And if you may find, okay, it may land you in trouble immediately, but it may not. And if it lands you in trouble, you may think, well, there's a way of getting around that. And this is one of those things. So you can see that you can get around the problem by constructing this thing called the Riemann sphere. This is the Riemann sphere right here. It's called the Riemann sphere because Riemann thought of it. I think that's a good enough reason. As far as I know, there wasn't somebody like Wessel who thought of it first. So if there is, I'll have to change calling it something else. But okay, as far as I know, it's the Riemann sphere. And how do we do this now? Okay, we take a sphere, perfectly nice sphere in ordinary three-dimensional Euclidean space, and I take the equator to that sphere, and I put a plane through the equator, and that plane is going to be the Wessel plane, or the complex plane. So I'll put the plane here, there it is. And there's a thing called the unit circle. That goes through 1 and I and minus 1 and minus I. So it's this circle here, very important, it's the unit circle. And that unit circle is supposed to coincide with the equator of the sphere. And then I take the south pole, and I project. It's called stereographic projection. It's a very beautiful kind of piece of geometry. I project from the south pole, and I'd say take a point U. That's some complex number. You see, that's a point on the Wessel plane there. I join it to the south pole and see where it goes. It makes this point up on the sphere. And I'm going to call that U on the sphere. 0 projects right up to the top. That's the north pole. Anything on the unit circle goes to itself. But then I have infinity. You see, infinity, if I tried to project onto the plane, it would go right out to infinity on the plane. That's where I got to when I was trying to do my construction over here. So infinity, when it's the sphere, it's right there. It's an honest point on the sphere. So the Riemann sphere includes infinity. Now we're going to come back to that because it's really important in not only quantum mechanics, but in relativity. And to me, this was a link. You see, we have something which is fundamental in quantum mechanics, and that's this Riemann sphere, and I'll try and explain why, and something else which is fundamental in relativity, and that's the sky, which we think of as also a Riemann sphere. And the link between them has to do with these fundamental complex numbers. And that is really the basic driving force behind twister theory. Okay, so now I'm going to come to this, but let me say a little bit more about relativity, because that's the easier one, if you like. It's, relativity may be confusing, but it's easier than quantum mechanics, I'll tell you. What we need to know is the light cones. Okay, and here you see this is the sort of basic structure in space-time. Space-time is four-dimensional. You get used to that by throwing one of the dimensions away. That's the usual way of doing it. So you think of the picture. I've just thrown a space dimension away. I have them all in this picture here, but this is the light cone, and you think to see what does it represent, a flash of light coming in to that point, and then you think of an explosion there, and that's this flash of light going out. And the history of that, you think of sections through it. That's now, that's the next moment, that's the moment after that. So that's now, that's the next moment. Think of that as the sphere now, not as, you see, it looks like an ellipse or a circle there, but it's really meant to be a sphere, and this is meant to be another sphere because of the extra dimension, and it's going out with the speed of light. Okay, so that's the light cone. And here's a picture of special relativity and lots of light cones all over the place, and they're uniformly arranged, and light rays have to go so that they're always tangent to the cone, and massive particles have to have their histories within the cones. And if you go to general relativity, which won't be relevant to this talk, I'm afraid, but these cones are still there but all over the place. Don't worry about that. You can think about the think about the special relativity, and that's fine, because that's all I'm going to be talking about in this lecture here. But if we now think about the picture that I had before, and I've now got a slightly different version of it, this is the celestial sphere, and you're looking at these four stars, and there's the past light cone, it intersects the points, and I'm really just saying that thing all over again. Differently moving observers perceive this sphere in such a way transformed from one observer to the other so that circular patterns go to circular patterns. Well, if you know more about these complex analytic functions and the holomorphic functions and so on, you find that if you want to have a transformation which takes this sphere, and now we're thinking of that as the Riemann sphere, that's the point, we think of that sphere, the sky, as this Riemann sphere, what's the point of thinking of it that way? Well, the point of thinking about it is that if you look at the transformations which transform the sphere into itself, but which preserve its structure as a holomorphic thing, that is, the equations that you use are holomorphic. They don't involve the complex conjugate. They only involve these adding, multiplying, taking limits. This kind of algebra, that kind of analysis which I'm trying to promote here. And if you ask for the holomorphic transformations of that sphere, see, if you're thinking complex, it's really not a sphere, it's a curve. Now, it doesn't look much like a curve, does it? But you see, that's because we think of curves in terms of real parameters. A real number will tell you how far you've gone along the curve. But if you think of a complex one, okay, it's two dimensions for a real person. It's the vessel plane, you see, it's a plane. But now when we fold it up into a sphere, it's a sphere. But it's really only one dimension because it's one complex dimension. So that's the idea you've got to get your mind around, that a complex dimension counts as two real dimensions. So this may look like a two-dimensional thing, but you think of it as a one-dimensional thing if you think complex. That's the idea. And when you think complex, you then got to think holomorphic too. And holomorphic, sending this into itself, the only transformations you can do are these ones. So the only transformations of the Riemann sphere to itself, which are genuinely holomorphic, are the ones which preserve circles. And they are the ones that you actually can get from one to the other by transforming from one observer to another. So that this complex geometry, the holomorphic geometry, is really revealing something about relativity. And it's not an obvious thing. In fact, the fact that circles go to circles, when you think about it a bit, it's a bit surprising. But it's, you think about it the right way, it becomes obvious. And the usual thing is to think about it the wrong way, of course, and then you have to wonder why it's true. I'm not going to explain that because that would be going too far afield. Okay. But that, to me, is one of the miracles. Okay, the sky, the transformation of the sky, if we think of the space of light rays, which is what I'm sort of doing here, those transformations are the ones which are holomorphic. Okay, now I think I'm going to say something about quantum mechanics. What is the most basic thing about quantum? I've talked about the most basic thing about relativity. It's this group, the Lorentz group, which can be understood as a holomorphic thing. Okay, what's the most basic thing about quantum mechanics? It's quantum linear superposition, which is both beautiful and very puzzling. If you have two states of a system, and I'm calling them A and B, then one of the basic rules of quantum mechanics, and if you talk of these as quantum states, when you think of big macroscopic things, it's a little puzzle. I'm not going to go into that one. That was basically, I think, the public lecture that was just mentioned, the first one I gave here. I was talking about these issues then. There are great puzzles about quantum mechanics when you try to apply them to big things, but let's not try and get into that one here. I'm just going to talk about how quantum mechanics works when you're really talking about objects which you really believe are quantum mechanical things. A and B are two possible states of your system. Then you can form combinations of W times A plus Z times B, where these are complex numbers. They've got to be complex numbers or it doesn't work. And that's physics. They're out there in the world. Now, we note another property of these state things, these things I've written with green capital letters, and if X is a state, that if you multiply it by a complex number, it doesn't change the physics. So these things are really what are called state vectors. They're a little bit more than the physics. They're the things that you use in the formalism of quantum mechanics. And if you multiply one of those things, a state vector, by a complex number which is not zero, you don't change the physics. So that means if you took this thing here, WA plus ZB, and I multiply it by Q, I get QW plus QZB, and it's the same physical thing, because multiplying by Q all the way through doesn't make any difference. But what I haven't changed is the ratio. The ratio of W to Z is the same as the ratio of QW to QZ. The Qs disappear. So the ratio of these things is what's important. So in any two-state quantum system, it's the ratio of these two numbers. They're called amplitudes, complex amplitudes. I may use that word from time to time, but there are these multipliers that you have here. They have to be complex numbers. Now, here is where our Riemann sphere comes in, and I'm going to reveal what's underneath here. This is one of the simplest quantum systems, and I've always found it an amazing one. Every time I think about it, I think it's amazing. If you have a particle like an electron, most of the basic particles which constitute matter, electrons, protons, neutrons, and the quarks, which are the constituents of protons and neutrons, they are all things which have what's called spin half. They spin at a certain rate, which is half in basic units. Now, a spin half particle is basically built up out of two independent states, and I'm calling them up and down. That means spinning right-handed about up. So you thought think of spinning about an axis, which is pointing in the direction so that the spin is right-handed about that direction. Or it could be spinning down right-handed about that. And those are the two basic states, if you like. And all the combinations that you can make, this is this superposition here, it's an instance of this basic principle of quantum mechanics, and I always regard this as amazing. All these combinations are another state pointing somewhere else. So you can produce other states as combinations of these two. And there's nothing special about up or down, after all. What's wrong with right and left? What's wrong with that way and that way? They're all just as good as each other. And the thing is that you can see, for that sort of reason, at least with this kind of system, these two basic states are no more particular than any other combination. They're just as good as each other. Okay, now there's a nice piece of geometry here, and you might have guessed what this nice piece of geometry is. As long as I can find my transparency. Oh, it's just here, isn't it? No wonder. It's there already. It's the Riemann sphere. Here we are. You see, how do we know which way this is pointing when you put W and Z in? Well, what you do is you form the quotient. I said it only depends on the ratio. So you form this ratio, which divide one by the other. Of course, it might be infinity if W happened to be naught, but we know we can deal with that now because it's just the Riemann sphere. And you take your point, W, Z over W. It's a point on the vessel plane. There it is. You do the projection I was just talking about before. It's a point on the sphere. The direction out from the origin to that point is the way it's pointing. So you have this beautiful connection between these funny parameters, these numbers in quantum mechanics, which are mysterious numbers that the mathematicians like to play with for many centuries, suddenly they're sitting there in physics. And they're there in the spins of these basic particles. Well, you have particles which have more complicated spins, but you can still see them there. They also have nice geometry. I don't want to go into that now. But this is where it's most manifest, and you can see that Riemann sphere really playing a role. And you see also, this also used to strike me, it depends on space being three dimensions. I don't know that I have to be a little nervous if there's string theorists in the audience who tell us that space ought to have lots more dimensions. That's one of the things, one of the reasons I never liked that idea particularly. Fine, strings are fine. What I don't like is having to put them in this huge number of dimensions because of things like this, which seem to tie these basic ideas to three dimensions of space and only three dimensions of space. Well, I'll show you another example of where this geometry comes in. And this, you can see, is getting closer to twisters because here we've got these lines with the little spirals around them. Those are meant to be spinning photons, say. So this could be a photon, and it could be spinning right-handed or spinning left-handed, and that's the symbol I'm going to use for right-handed and for left-handed. And the general case will again be these combinations, the same sorts of combinations which I'm doing here. And these will be the other ways that a photon can spin. It can have elliptical polarization or plane polarization. And if you want to see how that relates to the Riemann sphere, well, it does. You take, this is what you have to do now. It happens to, because there's photon is a thing called spin 1 and not spin half, and that means the reason for the square root is to do with that. Let's not go into that, though. But you need to take not just the ratio, but also the square root of the ratio, and that's a point Q on the Riemann sphere. Let's suppose the photon is going upwards here, so that's the direction of it. The point Q is some other point on the sphere determined by these numbers here. You now look at the direction out to Q. You form a great circle, which is in the plane perpendicular to that direction, and that's a circle now on the sphere. You project it down in the direction of the motion here. You project it down, and you get an ellipse on the vessel plane, and that ellipse is the polarization ellipse. So you can directly relate the polarization of this spinning particle again to the Riemann sphere. Okay, well, that's all very nice. Now I'm going to tell you something that's nice, but it's very strange. And this is part of the point of this talk, quantum non-locality. You see, there are these very strange things. Well, it's basically Einstein who started worrying about these things first. He was, I think, trying to poke a hole in quantum mechanics because he, even though he's one of the people who started the subject, he didn't like the way it went, because that's not the only case where that's happened in science. But in this case, he thought there must be something wrong, and so he pointed out things that were very strange implications of quantum mechanics, thinking that they were going to show quantum mechanics was wrong. Unfortunately, in this case, it showed that he was wrong and that quantum mechanics was right. But they were very insightful things to point out. And these contributions from Einstein and his colleagues, Podolsky and Rosen and David Bohm, which is more like the specific case I'm showing you here, he's pointing out that quantum mechanics does have these very, very strange implications. Now, here we have something starts off in a state of spin zero. That means there's no direction it's got to it at all. It's a symmetrical thing. And it splits into two particles, each of spin half, so they're like the ones described here. And the spin over here and here have this property that they're opposite. Now, I should say, this is one of the very strange things about quantum mechanics, it may be that the thing is spinning in some direction. Now, how would you ever know? Well, you could say, well, let's measure its spin. But the thing is, when you measure the spin, there's only one bit of information you can ever get out of the spin of a spin half particle. So you choose your direction, say, well, let's try this one. Well, if you tried that one, and you got it right, you see, if you tried that one, you tried that direction, you say, it says, yes, I am indeed spinning that way. If you tried something else, it would only give you probability. If I tried the opposite one, said, no, I'm spinning the opposite way, if I tried this direction, it would be 50% chance that one way or the other way. That's all you can get. It'll just say yes or no, this way or that way. It won't say no, which direction it's spinning. So that's one of these funny things. The state tells you which way it's spinning, but you don't know what the state is. And you can't tell by doing a measurement to work out what that state is. So it's quite subtle to know that these things are spinning oppositely. You might choose to measure its spin this way, and then you know if somebody else measured this one, it would come out this way, but they might measure it some other direction, you see. Well, John Bell introduced these things called Bell inequalities. I don't think he called them that. That's what other people call them. These are to do with ways of distinguishing this very strange behavior of quantum mechanics from the way in which a classical system could behave. You could imagine that these particles coming out here are some piece of machinery, say, each one. And they start off together with some rules about how the machinery on this one is related to the machinery on that one. And what Bell shows is that the way quantum mechanics behave simply can't be explained that way. If these things are not in communication after they've separated, there is no way that they can imitate what quantum mechanics actually says they do. And this is quantum non-locality. It was really John Bell who showed that these were real things. Quantum mechanics behaves in a way, and it is a very subtle thing, because you might say either these things are in communication or they're not. If they're in communication, this one could send a signal to the other one and say, look, I've just been measured, had my spin measured this way, be careful to measure yours, you know, the other way, something like that. You could have messages like that. That's communication. But it's not like that. Because if it was like that, you could violate relativity. You could send a signal faster than light, and that would violate relativity. Because these things could be photons and not spin half. In fact, they usually are photons. In which case, you can't get a signal back to the other one. He couldn't say, look, I've been measured this way. You better make sure you do it the other way. It's too late, you see, because the signal can't get over there. But nevertheless, they are what's called entangled. That word entangled was introduced by Schrödinger to explain the kind of system, the situation that comes here. So it's these very strange entanglements. There's something between being in communication and being independent. And it's a subtle thing you never get in ordinary, you get only in quantum mechanics. These things are not independent because of these funny behaviors. I'll give you an example of one in a minute. These funny behaviors, and they're not able to communicate with each other either. It's something between those two. Very subtle, sophisticated phenomenon, which is non-local in some definite sense, but not explicable in terms of signals going faster than light, because you're not supposed to have those. That would ruin relativity. Now, there are examples using photons. I'm not quite sure what the record is at the moment, but the distances, you see, you think of quantum mechanics as being about small things. Okay, the things are small, all right. These could be photons, small in a sense, but they can be awfully far apart. In fact, as far as we know, there's no limit to the distance apart that they can be. And there are experiments which have been performed in Switzerland. I'm not quite sure what the record is here, but at least over 100 kilometers. So photons separated by 100 kilometers, and they have these entanglements between each other at which they seem to be part of one system. They can't communicate this information to each other, but you can't explain them as being separated from each other. They're still entangled. Well, the nicest example, the simplest example of this, I'll show you that one, is one by Lucien Hardy of Perimeter Institute, I'm glad to say. So let me try and describe Lucien's very beautiful example. It's not quite what we have here. It doesn't start from a spin zero system. It has to start from a thing which has spin one. It's the next case up from spin half. And it's this particular state. You can put it in this state. I've put some arrows here to try and indicate which state it is if you happen to know about these things, but don't worry about it. There's some state here, and it goes off a long way away. These could be, you know, miles apart. And you might choose to measure the spin of these things. Now, the rules of this game are going to be that the person over here, the right-hand person, is going to measure either up-down, and it's going to say, if you say up-down, it's going to say, yes, I'm up, or yes, I'm down, or no to up, if you like, or right-left. There's a choice between those two, up-down or right-left. And the one on the left is going to do the same thing, up-down or right-left. Now, let's imagine that these clever particles here have sorted out between themselves what they're going to do. And then now they're out of communication. So that's the kind of thing that you would think would happen if these were classical objects, certainly. Now, there are certain rules that you find, and Lucien has worked these out, so the rules will always hold. There are four things that these people could do. They could measure up, down, left-right, up, down, left-right here, and up, down there, or left-right, left-right, whichever it was. And the rules are that sometimes, this is the only thing which isn't just yes or no, sometimes it must be the case, and it's about probability of a 12th, maybe out of 12 occasions where these things get emitted, roughly speaking, there will be one of these which does the following. That if it happens to be the case that the two observers measure up, down, that they sometimes both get down. And that has to happen about 1 out of 12 of the times that they choose it down. So these little particle people down here have to decide that these things must occasionally, 1 out of 12 about, say that if they're measured up and down, they will sometimes give down, down. Okay. But they don't know which way they're going to be measured. So it might be that the one on the left didn't do up and down, but did right left instead. Now, the rules come out, quantum mechanics tells you that you never get left for this one and down for this one. You never get down for this one and left for this one. And you never get right for this one and right for this one. So those are the rules. Okay, now what's wrong with all that? Well, okay, sometimes I say it will do this. So let's suppose that these things have come apart and the one on the left has decided, instead of measuring up and down, left, right. Well, we know that the rules tell us that if this one is going to come down, this one has not allowed to be left, so it's got to be right. Okay, but they didn't know it was going to do that, and they might not have done that. They might have done it the other way. This one did do up, down, but the one on the right-hand side decided to do left, right instead. Now, these rules tell you that if this one's going to be down, as it has to be from this, this one has not allowed to be left, and so it's got to be right. But then, suppose neither of these had been up and down, and this fellow, the people in here, didn't know that. So it could have been both left, right. And since this, we found out that this one's got to measure left, and this one's got to measure left, in this case, but that's not allowed. So they can't get it right. You always can catch them out, one way or another, if they are what's called local realistic model. If it's a local realistic model, that is to say that these pieces of machinery which are trying to imitate quantum mechanics, okay, they can confer with themselves right at the beginning and decide what they're going to do, but from there on, they're out of communication. There's no way of imitating this behavior. So that's a nice example, nice enough that I can actually sort of explain it here. Can't explain why it does it, but that's what the rules of quantum mechanics come out with this answer. And indeed, this is the answer that experiments give you. You don't do it with with particles, you're more likely to use photons. And so this is, in a sense, why I showed you this picture, because these are the things you would use, and it would be this system instead. But that's equivalent. I mean, it's the same idea. Okay, that's space-time seems to have this very strange kind of entanglement built into it. And it's something people genuinely worry about for good reason. Now, I want to try, in order to get to the point where I can explain where Twister theory has anything to say about it, which probably I've only left myself ridiculously small amount of time to explain it to you. Never mind, I'll do my best. I wanted to tell you all that because it's really rather fascinating. I have to tell you some more about quantum mechanics, I'm afraid. Okay, I told you about the quantum superposition of two states, which is what we see an example of here, but it really goes on to lots and lots of states. And you say you might have a particle in one place, or another place, or another place, or another place, and each one of these could have its quantum complex number attached to it. And so every position in space would need a complex number. And I've tried to lump them all together here. Each one is labeled by a complex number. This is what we call the wave function. The wave function of a particle is really just telling you what these complex numbers are for each position it could have. X is the position, and psi of X is telling you what that complex number is at that position. That's the wave function. Very fundamental to quantum mechanics. It's the basis of the Schrodinger approach to quantum mechanics. Now, what about several particles? You see, if you have lots of particles, then the particles can be here, here, and here, and we've got an amplitude for that. Here, here, and here. Well, there are supposed to be four of them here, that's right. Or there could be here, here, and here, and here. And all of those different arrangements all together have to have one of these complex multipliers. So the psi, the wave function, is a function of all these numbers together. And that's where this entanglement comes from. Because it's not just that each one separately has a quantum amplitude for where it is. It's the whole collection altogether has one of these quantum amplitudes associated with it. So that the wave function is a function of all these things. You might be lucky and find that it splits into this product. But if it doesn't, that's what's called an entangled state. So in fact, most of the states are going to be a great entangled mess. In fact, it's a great puzzle to me why we don't see that. Okay, you can detect these things in quantum mechanics, but quantum mechanics doesn't really tell you why we're not all a great entangled mess. We don't seem to be, at least I hope not. Now, okay, I've told you about wave functions now, that's not bad. Now, I'm going to tell you about another kind of wave functions. These are position state wave functions, the ordinary Schrodinger idea. But you can also talk about momentum state wave functions. A particle here could be moving that way, or that way, or that way. The momentum is the mass times its velocity. Velocity can have different directions. So again, it could be going this way, or this way, or this way, or this way. And each of these possibilities separately has this complex number attached to it. And so again, you have this thing, which is again a wave function, but this time dependent on the momenta. So that's a momentum state wave function. And there's clever ways from getting from this kind to this kind, which use what's called a Fourier transform. A nice piece of mathematics, but I'm not going to worry about it. I am going to tell you something very mysterious, though. That the momentum p and the position x are what are called canonical conjugate variables. And people doing quantum mechanics love these things because, I'll tell you why in a sense. And it's very mysterious, but it's all part of the way quantum mechanics works. That if you're working in momentum space and you want to know how to talk about position, it's not allowed to be in there, but the position turns out to be differentiation with respect to momentum. Now, if you don't know what that means, I'm not going to try and explain it to you. It's telling you how the rate at which things change, so that as the momentum changes, the rate of change is this position. Well, that's a funny thing, isn't it? There's actually one of these has got a minus sign, but I couldn't remember which was which when I was making the slide, so I imagine one of them's got a minus sign in it. But never mind too much about that. See, if I'd used the spatial, this one over here, what's momentum? Well, it's differentiation with respect to position. That's a strange thing. That's the way quantum mechanics works. Don't worry too much about that, except I'm going to use it in a minute in twisters. This is the standard quantum mechanics. That's nothing twisters about this. But I'm going to do something rather like that. And the reason I'm doing it is because that's what you do in quantum mechanics. And, well, let me leave that one there if you like. Okay, back to twisters. Now, I'm going to, if you remember my original picture here, like this, why don't I just do that? I'm going to say a bit more about this space here. Here is Minkowski space. That's the space of space-time of special relativity. And here is a light ray in that space-time of special relativity. And here is the point which represents that light ray. It's just this picture here. That's that point representing that light ray. Now I'm going to add a bit to it. You see, twister space is really a bit more than this space. Why is it a bit more? Well, you see, if we look over here, the nice idea would be to say, well, that Riemann sphere, you've got these Riemann spheres all over the place, and remember what a Riemann sphere is. It's a curve, but it's a curve if you're a complex person. And we're trying to do things as complex as we can, complex in the sense of complex numbers. So that means that this is really a curve, and it has to be a holomorphic thing to be a proper point in space-time. That was what I was saying here. But it would be awfully nice if this whole space was a complex space. If the whole space was a complex space, then these Riemann spheres would just automatically be sitting there, and you'd know where you are, and it would be a very beautiful piece of geometry. It doesn't work for a very good reason, because if you count the number of dimensions of these light rays, it comes out as 5. It's just the number of parameters you need to specify where the ray is. So that means that this space here is 5-dimensional. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with that is that 5 is an odd number. And every space, complex space, in real number terms, has to be even, because each dimension counts as 2. Each complex dimension counts as 2 real dimensions. 5 dimensions is no good. Well, fortunately, I wouldn't have been talking about this if there hadn't been a way out. There's a bigger space, which is 6 real dimensions, and this 6-dimensional space is indeed a complex space. And it's a very well-known one, if you happen to know these things. It's defined in quite a simple way. You take 4 complex numbers, you look at their ratios, and these are 3 independent complex ratios. It's what we call a projective space, complex projective space, and that's this thing over here. Okay, and then I put these Zs, and then you have a... If you want to know where this place in the middle is, which I've called that, it's the space of the light rays, you have to write down an equation like this, which you see has these bars on it, which means it's not holomorphic. Okay, I clearly I'm not going to have time to explain all these things in detail, but I want just to give you a general picture of this thing. How do we understand this space? Well, first of all, I'm going to put... Oh, it's getting complicated here. This is the Riemann sphere, which I like to draw as a little sausage, because it's not... You see, it's also a straight line, you see. It's a sphere and a straight line at the same time. The best thing I can do is making it look like a sausage. But sometimes I'll draw it as a straight line. And there's this important thing, which is called incidence, which is when this point lies on the sausage, and that's the same as when this cone lies on the line, you see. So you can see when they're going to come together. And that incidence relation is written on the other transparency. It's really the basis of twister theory. But it's written at the bottom in a form which you probably have to know about matrices to know. But there it is. There it is. It's a nice simple equation, really. Well, let me show you a bit of geometry. That whole construction is really telling you that the twister space, this complex projective space, it's a space which has got points in it. It's got these lines. Here's where my sausage looks like a line now, you see, because it's got straight lines in it, this space, and it's got planes in it. Those are the basic things. And this is the space-time, but it's all made complex. And I think I'm going to leave this picture here only for the experts, you see, because I've got my transparencies, which some of these are with complicated formulae in it, and I don't expect everybody to wade through my formulae. But on the other hand, there are a few people here who probably want to see the formulae. So I put them on one side, and I'll talk on the other side. But so this is not formulae here, but it's part of the nice geometry that you get here. This is meant to be Minkowski space. It doesn't look as flat as Minkowski space does, because I put infinity into it, infinity in the picture too. Don't worry too much about it. This is the geometry. It's just nice to have these colored pictures. So I'll leave that down there. But I want to try and explain something else, which is this. What does a twister actually look like? Why is it called a twister? Okay, it's not such a complicated piece of geometry. It does, in a sense, depend on this, but not too hard. Here we have a point in this twister space. Now, if that point happens to lie on this space in the middle, you see, that's this five-dimensional space which I started with. We know what it is. It's a light ray. But if it doesn't lie in that space, suppose it lies in the bigger space out here, which is the six-dimensional space, how do you picture it? Well, one way of doing it is, there it is, sitting in the bigger space. Here is the line which represents the point in space-time. And that point, I can draw the plane through that line and through that point. Now, that plane, you see, when you talk about twisters, you find that there's a sort of duality between planes and points. So if you've got that plane, you take what's called its complex conjugate, you put a bar over the top of it, that's this complex conjugate, and then it becomes a point again. So W is the plane, W bar is a point, and that means it's a light ray. So that means that given your line in this part of space-time, which represents the light rays, okay, that's a point in space-time now. So the green thing is the point in space-time, there it is. And the W is represented by that light ray. Now, wherever I happen to choose that point, it could be anywhere, I'd have a light ray through it. What is that configuration of light rays for point up here? Well, it's that. So if you take any point, and it could be a point sitting here, you see where the arrow is, there's a circle going through it, and that's telling you that the light ray is going off in that direction. Okay, that's a little bit difficult to see, and I admit that. But this was really what started off twister theory. And it's why they're called twisters, because this twisting thing is zipping along with the speed of light, and it represents the twister. It also represents something about the angular momentum of mass, a particle without any mass. So I could describe it in those terms, but I think I won't do that now. Okay, so that explains this picture. You don't much use these things very often. It's very nice to have it, and you can put that in the front of your book or something, but it's hardly ever actually used in the analysis which twister theory takes advantage of. Okay, now I slap down. This is really more for the expert, you see. These are just the equations. Don't bother with that if you're not an expert. But these are the equations that we need, the basic equations for twister theory. Notice that one thing I do want to point out, though, is that the Z thing, that was the coordinates I had originally for the twister, and that was Z too. I tend to use Z for the twister. It splits into two bits, and I want to explain what those two bits are. Those two bits are what are called spinners, and you can sort of understand the spinners. This is all part of why twister theory is a little bit complicated, because you've got to learn all these things properly. I'm just going to throw them at you. A two-spinner, well, you see, it's something like a bit like a vector, but it's very specially associated with the light cone. It points along the light cone, so it's a particle like a photon might be zipping along with the speed of light, and so its direction of motion, and in fact its momentum, which tells you what the frequency of that light is, it tells you how energetic it is, the momentum of that photon is also gauged by the length of this vector here. So you've got a little bit more information than which way it's moving. You know how energetic it is, what its frequency is, if you like, or what its momentum is. There's one other thing here. There's this thing called a flag plane, which you must think of as being tangent to this cone. That's very hard to picture because you need all the dimensions here, really. But to get the dimensions, I take a slice through the cone, and that's a sphere. Remember that? We did that before. This point here, representing the actual direction of the photon, is a point on that slice through it. And this flag plane is a little arrow at that point. That describes the geometrical structure of the spinner. There's an algebra of these things. They have two components. I've got xi naught is the W and xi 1 is the Z. And these are the same W's and Z's that we saw before. so that the spinner is somehow picking up these two complex numbers, which tell you how to add spins together to make other directions of spins. And there's a nice calculus of these spinners, which I'm using over here, you see. So those of you who like all these things can look very carefully at these transparencies. And at the bottom, I've got a formula which tells you how the momentum and the angular momentum of this spinning object, which is going to be described by a twister, how it's constructed out of these two spinners, which I shall now put down here, which I call omega and pi. I know that the people who work on high energy physics with twisters have used lambda and mu or something, which I regard as a mistake because they got it from my first paper on twister theory where I used all the wrong conventions. And they picked up on this and they use all the wrong conventions too. But I later came to my senses and realized what the right conventions were, but nobody, at least, I'm exaggerating. Okay, what I'm claiming are the right conventions are the ones I'm using here, where the two parts of the twister, which I'm calling omega and pi, are telling you some nice, clear things. Pi is telling you the momentum of the particle, the massless particle, or could be a photon, if you like. And omega is telling you basically the angular momentum of it. Well, if you have this picture down at the bottom, that gives you a sort of picture of it. Here is this twister thing zipping along with the speed of light with its twists. It's got this angular momentum, its spin as well. And here is pi pointing out that way. And where is omega? Well, you take the light cone of the origin and see where this meets it, and then omega points out that way. So for this is actually for what we call a null twister, which happens to be the simpler ones, but never mind about that. It's just a pretty good picture of a twister. That's pi is telling you where it's going, and omega is, roughly speaking, telling you the moment of it about this origin, telling you where it is. So those two things together tell you all you need to know about the twister. Okay, now where are we getting here? The next thing is, I'm going to talk about twister wave functions. Well, I'm not going to, really, because I'm going to, this is the expert slide over here, you see. So you can read all that. Remember, I had wave functions of position, and I had wave functions of momentum. Now I'm going to do wave functions of twisters. That's the thing. So rather than using either momentum or position, I'm going to use twisters. And I could either use twisters, which were the points in the space-time, or I could use the dual twisters, which were the planes, and I did start talking about them over here, and you have to take complex conjugates to go from one to the other. But you can use either one representation or the other representation. And then you find this thing I said before, they look like derivatives and all that sort of thing. And what you find is that these functions have to be holomorphic. That's the beauty of it. You're necessarily in this realm of complex analytic or holomorphic geometry. Because, you see, in ordinary quantum mechanics, you say that the wave function, if it's a position wave function, there mustn't be any momentum coordinates in there. It's just got to be position coordinates. If you use the momentum representation, there mustn't be any position coordinates. It's just the momentum coordinates. To get the others, you've got to do this funny stuff with the derivatives. It's just the same with twister theory. But it's here that Zs, or the Z bars, which I called W a minute ago, and it's one or the other. You can't use both. But here it's very, see, here the choice is quite a big thing, because momentum is nothing like position. Whereas here, the twister and the dual twister, it's just a question of handedness. You're either looking at right-handed or left-handed. And it's quite strange that this is a very much more subtle choice that you make here. Well, for the experts, I'll tell them all about this thing here, too. Let me step to the next thing. Oh, this is an expert slide, too. You see, I've got all these equations here. See, suppose you want to describe the wave function of a particle which has no mass. Now, it could be a photon, or it could be a neutrino. Well, a neutrino has a bit of a mass, but you could pretend it doesn't. Or a graviton. Well, we don't know about gravitons because you have to quantize gravity first, but they're probably there. Any massless particle, it has an equation a wave function equation, which looks like these things. And I'm not even going to attempt to explain these equations because they use all the thing. And then you can translate between the spinners to the space-time terms. And then you find that all these equations automatically get solved by simply using a twister, which is a function which is holomorphic. So again, it's an expert slide, which I'll just throw at you. So here we have, see these Fs in here, they devolve the omegas and the pis, and they're just holomorphic. Well, they might have to be homogeneous too. What homogeneous mean? What means if you multiply this up by a number and that by the same number, that number comes out of the function by raised to some power. Well, don't worry about that. But the homogeneity degree is the spin, how much spin there is of the particle. Well, that's just, get the hang of that when you know about these things. But the point is that you don't need to solve these equations. They're automatically solved by this nice little formula. You take your function, which is holomorphic. Okay, it's got to be homogeneous if you don't want to mix the helicities up, but don't worry too much about that. It's holomorphic is the key thing. And what you can do to a holomorphic function is integrate it. And that's the thing that people who work with complex analysis are doing all the time. You integrate these blasted things. And you integrate them around little loops. Well, Riemann spheres, you see, that's very handy. I'm just going to give you the answer. Here is twister space. And remember, it was divided into a top and a bottom half. Well, I don't think I said that very clearly before, but it is. It's divided into a top and a bottom half. Now, for a wave function, you just look at the top half. You forget about the bottom half. And the reason for that is that when you do these integrals and things, you come up with something which really is a wave function. Wave functions have to satisfy all sorts of properties, and one of them is that they're what's called positive frequency. They mustn't involve negative energies. So they should really be positive energy things. And that's a little bit of a nuisance when you're talking about ordinary functions. You not only have got to solve these equations, you've got to put in the positive frequency thing and all that stuff. I should say these equations really are quite simple to solve if you know about it, but don't worry. They're not automatically solved. You've got to solve them. Whereas here, the twister function already does it for you. It already makes it holomorphic. It already makes it solve the equations. It already makes it positive frequency. It does all the things you want for a wave function. There is something strange about them. And this strange thing worried me for a long time. It was doing all the things I had hoped for, beautiful, but something very strange about it. And the strange thing is in these camel humps here. The function is defined on a space which has got bits taken out of it. And what's the point of that? And the main thing is they've got to be separated. And the reason is to have a function with bits which are separated, which means that when you take a line up here, it cuts these holes into two separate places. And then you can do your integral around separating the holes. Okay, if you know about contour integrals, you know why that's important. But I'm not going to worry about that here. I'm just going to say that there is this strange thing about the function having to be defined on a region which has two separate holes in it. Why do I say holes? Well, it means if you try to extend your function through into the hole, you'd run into what are called singularities. The thing would blow up, and you couldn't go any further. It'd get stuck. Now, it took a long time to realize what's going on here. So let me try and explain it. This is the key point in this talk, so don't go away just yet. It's a thing called twister cohomology. Now, I've had some fancy words already. Holomorphic. This is another fancy word. I'm going to try and explain it to you, though. And it explains the camel humps taken out. Okay, I'm trying to understand the top half of twister space. That's the key place where these functions are defined. And I want to say two things about this place. Well, one is that it can be built up by joining these two. You see, you imagine take this with one camel hump taken out, and this one with the other one taken out. And if I take the union of the two, that is, I stick one over on top of the other, and I look at where there is any of the space, and forget about the camel humps, and it's the whole space. The other thing I can do is to take the intersection of the two. That means if I put this on top of the other, I look at where either of them has a camel hump tape and that, and I've got this space. Now the thing is that where the function is defined, this beautiful holomorphic function, is on this region here. Whereas what you're interested, the space you're interested in, is the whole region. Now, what this is what's called an element of first cohomology. And either I can explain that by showing you this transparency, which has got all the equations on it, or I can show you this picture. Now that is a nice demonstration of cohomology. It really came about because a long time ago there were some people trying to make a movie, television film. They did actually make it, but it was trying to say something about twisters. I don't know whether it was successful or not. And I said, in a weak moment, I said, well, something is to do with cohomology. And they said, oh, what's that? I said, I couldn't really explain that. I said, well, we might want to put that on the television program. And I thought, that's impossible. How can you explain this on a television program? But then I went away, I went home, and I thought, maybe this explains it. So let me try and explain what cohomology is by means of this picture. It's a precise, non-local measure of the impossibility of this picture. Now, you see, it's not all that impossible, because if I cut one of the corners off, you could make that thing out of wood. Or I could cut this corner off, you could make that out of wood. Or I could cut that one off, or I could even take a little bit out there. You could make that too. What you can't make is that. So locally, it's perfectly sensible. The problem is in the impossibility of the whole structure. Okay, another way of thinking about that is, let's try and build one. Okay, I'm going to build one. I start with that corner. I hope I've got it the right way. I can't see these things very well. Yes, okay. Okay, that's fine. And then I build another corner, and I glue that on there. I said, the instruction manual tells me you've got to glue that piece on there. Okay, so I do that, that's fine. And then I find, oh, there's the last piece, and I've made this final bit. Here it is. And I guess it's this way up. And it tells me how to glue that onto that, and it tells me how to glue that onto that. And then I try and glue it onto there, of course. Well, then I find it doesn't work. Well, what you have to do is you get these instructions, and that's what these functions are really doing, you see. They're instructions about how to fit your function together. And does it fit? Or is there a glitch? And that glitch is a non-local thing, as I tried to say. It's not, the problem's not here. I could glitch it, glue it there. The problem's not here. I could glue that. The problem's not here. It's not there together. The problem is when I try and put them all together. And you do that fancy little bit of mathematics that I've got here, and that tells you whether you can do it or not. The cohomology element is the element which tells you how impossible it is. Is it possible or isn't it? Now, that's exactly what these twisted wave functions are like. Now, what is that to do with non-locality in quantum mechanics? Well, I'm going to give you an even simpler example. I told you the Lucien-Hardy example. This is even simpler, but it's not doing the same thing. It's something simpler because it's an only one particle non-locality. And this is, well, here we have a source of a photon. And this is its wave function spreading out over here. It's called a wave function, if you like, because it's a bit like waves. So you've got these waves coming out. You could imagine them as being water waves, perhaps. Here we have a screen. Now, the screen, the wave function tells you how likely it is to receive that particle here, how likely it is to receive it here, and you could say it's the intensity of the wave which tells you the probability of seeing it here or here. But suppose you see it here. Suppose there's somebody sitting here and says, whoops, I've seen it, too late, you can't see it, I've seen the photon. And so that signal to send, too late, I've seen it, would have to travel faster than light in order to get to every other point on the screen to say, you're not allowed to see that photon, it's been seen. That's non-local. It's a non-locality that's already there in a single wave function, single particle wave function. And I'm trying to say that that's a bit like this. In fact, it's very much like this, because you see, this is like your twister wave function. It's spread out. Okay, this is a space-time view of it, but in twister space, or in the space of these light rays, it's spread out, and it's got this kind of glitch to it. You make a measurement here, and you've somehow broken it. The information is fed out from where you've made your measurement into something else which does the measurement. And from there on, the impossibility is removed. So that there is this tension in this wave function, which is this impossibility of the structure, which once it's measured somewhere, it's released, and the thing can't be seen anywhere else. And it's a kind of non-locality that is featured in this cohomology, which you already see in the twister wave function, which is reflecting this kind of non-locality here. Okay, well, in the Lucy and Hardy example, in the general Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen examples, you're talking about two particles. So you then have to say, in twister theory, how do you describe a two-particle wave function? Well, it's cohomology again, but it's second cohomology. And I can't describe it simply like this. In fact, I set this, I don't know how many years ago, probably about 30 years ago or something, to students. I said, look, here's a nice example of first cohomology. Find me an example which does as well with second cohomology. Well, nobody's come up with a nice example yet. Maybe there is one, but it's the kind of thing when you have two particles and you want to see how this entanglement between those two particles is expressed in a kind of tension of this nature. Well, you can mathematically, you can understand that a second cohomology, yes, it's there. But to see it in a more kind of concrete way is something for the future. Maybe somebody will come up with a nice way of expressing that. And then maybe these entanglements will not seem so mysterious as they do now. The point I'm trying to make is that if you look at it from the twister perspective, in a certain sense, these non-localities become rather more natural and not so, I mean, this kind of cohomology is the kind of thing that mathematicians, when studying complex spaces, simply come up with automatically. I mean, they've been doing this thing for years, to try and understand complex spaces of higher dimension. But to see that playing a role in physics is really exciting and very nice if you like geometry, especially if you like this kind of complex geometry, and it's perhaps revealing something deep about the world operates. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. So we are now going to open the floor to questions. So if you do have a question, just please raise your hand and we will run a microphone to you. So let's start right here.
I too am a big fan of the complex plane. I think it's a really beautiful structure. And what I was wondering was if you thought if there was any connection between the Mandelbrot sat, which is a very beautiful object that lives in the complex plane, if there's anything that relates to physics. Because I've been working on a theory. I have something I'd like to give you that I've written, but I'd like to see if you've thought about this before.
That was the Mandelbrot set.
Mandelbrot set, yeah.
Yes, no, it's fascinating. I think there must be a connection. I don't know if everybody knows about these things. These are absolutely extraordinary sets, which are, have you got a picture of one? Yes. Well, there's a nice picture of one, but I don't know whether you can see terribly well from the distance. But you see these very, very complicated structures with all sorts of swirls and frills and things. And the amazing thing about them is that they come out of a very simple prescription in the complex plane. You say, take the vessel plane, you have a very simple map, and you ask if you repeat that thing many, many times, and if it's, does it drift off to infinity or does it stay local or not? And what's so strange is that the division between the ones where it drifts off to infinity and the local ones is a very, very complicated set. And you can sort of zoom in this set. People do it with computers. You fix a certain point on the edge of the set, you zoom in, and you see these very, very complicated things there. I think it's very likely that there is a role for this kind of thing. It's something which you see in very simple functions of complex parameters, and this extraordinary complication is sitting there. I don't know directly any role for the Mandelbrot set, so I can't say, yes, we see it in such and such. All I can say is that I'm as impressed by them as you are, and that we do see a lot of complication in nature. And it's one of the things that often puzzle me. How is it that if we, on the one hand, believe that nature is at root very simple, and on the other hand, we see this extraordinary complication around us, and there's something to understand how this complication can arise out of very simple rules. And the Mandelbrot set is a very wonderful example which does that, and it does it through the complex functions, these complex numbers and so on. It's where you see these things in their most manifest and, I think, most attractive. There are other sets of this nature which don't use complex numbers, but I think the most attractive ones are definitely the ones that come about through these complex functions. So I thank you for your question. It's very close to my heart, that kind of idea.
A new theory maybe gives you an increased understanding. Maybe string theory explains things that weren't explained before, or relativity explains things that weren't discovered before, or makes it more elegant. The twisters, in a nutshell, what would be the thing that it explains either better or easier in terms of physics?
Well, there has been a sort of revolution in recent years. In, I think it was 2003, Ed Witten, who is the sort of grand mogul of string theory, who certainly has made amazing contributions to that area. But he wrote an article where he pointed out how ideas from string theory could be combined with ideas from twister theory. He was one of the few people who really did understand about twister theory, apart from people who specialize in twister theory. So he knew about these things. And he was able to point out how you could combine the ideas of string theory and twister theory to simplify calculations. Well, there was some other work by some other people and so on. But anyway, his work started a kind of wave of interest, I think partly because whatever Witten did, lots of other people would be stimulated to follow in that route because of he has a reputation that the things he thinks of tend to be very fruitful. And although the role of strings has somewhat faded in the work that's been done recently, it certainly has simplified calculations. There's three things that attracted me about it. Witten told me about this when I visited Princeton, and I had no idea what he was going to tell me about. He wanted to talk to me about something. And he started describing this idea, and the first thing that puzzled me was that it was actually in four dimensions, that is, the standard number of space and time dimensions, rather than the 10 dimensions or 11 dimensions or whatever it happens to be. So that sort of I picked up at that point. And secondly, it was talking about physics that we really know is genuine physics, because it's the kind of physics that's relevant to the Large Hadron Collider, the LHC, and the kind of results that they're going to be producing very soon, or have produced, to get an understanding of the meaning of these observations that you get from the LHC, you have to know what standard theory predicts. Now, to do that, people have been using methods which you'd have a whole book, much fatter than that, to do certain simple calculations. In order to do that, you use the standard techniques, and you need a book which has been worked out by a computer. Okay, you have to have the rules originally, but it's basically computer calculations. And it turned out that you could do these calculations basically on the back of an envelope, that they were very simple. The formula, the answers were very, very simple. Okay, Witten subsequently went off and did some other things, but he started this activity which brought together string theorists and twister theorists and also high energy physicists. And it's a new wave of activity which is really exciting. Now, I should make a comment about this. You see, there's a certain irony, because in a certain sense, twister theory was trying to move forward and get deeper understanding of things we didn't know about, you see. Is there some hidden order about nature that it would reveal to us, which is different from the order that we have at the moment? The use of twister theory in these calculations is taking standard theory, the theory which we believe to be conventional physics and do calculations which were not feasible before. And these calculations, which have been carried out, not by me, because I've been, a lot of these things I only barely understand what they do. The most gratifying thing to me has been a long-time, originally student and then colleague, Andrew Hodges, who is also known for his wonderful biography of Alan Turing. He'd been working away on this kind of twister theory, more or less by himself, the occasional student, for many, many years. And suddenly, all this work of his has been brought to life in terms of this new activity. And it's really fascinating to watch. At the moment, it's moving ahead again in new ways, which do depend to a very considerable degree on twister theory. But this is the conventional physics. It's what in the LHC would be saying, well, you know, if we see something in the LHC, is this something new or is it something that the conventional theory predicts? Well, you go to these calculations and where the twister theory is used, and you say, well, conventional theory says so-and-so. And they say, oh, yeah, that's all right. Well, that's what we see, so it's not exciting. Whereas if you see something different, that's where it's exciting. So that's where the irony is, if you like.
Thank you. Let's take one last question.
I'm wondering what the relationship between your twisters are with the toroid geometry.
I didn't quite hear what geometry?
Toroid, the torus geometry, that picture you showed of the...
Oh, the torus.
Yes, yes.
Well, that's, you see, it's not really a torus. You see, each torus has these circles. If you take an ordinary torus, which is a circular, say a donut, which has a circular cross-section and a circle rotated around, then you've got circles going around it and circles going the long way around, but then you've got some less obvious circles, which is the one to twist once through the torus. And you have whole families of those. That was the picture I had, is these sort of nested tori and these circles drawn on them. It's a configuration which is known as Clifford parallels. These are projected Clifford parallels. They've been known since the 19th century, but the use of them in this context is come about through twister theory. Well, I was familiar with these configurations, which is what made me think of these things in the first place, really. But I don't think that plays a very important role in... I mean, the fact that they sit on these toruses, or tori, is just a feature of the geometry. It comes in useful sometimes when you're looking at integrals and things to make use of these things, but I'm not sure that I would say there's anything about space-time structure that's interesting in that torus structure. That's about all I can say at the moment. But yes, they're, you see them in that configuration. That's certainly right.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sir Roger Penrose.